From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. We know the British philosopher John Locke influenced the American founders. A Duke University professor contends that Locke also could be dubbed the first modern economist. You'll learn why. Concerns about a chemical dubbed Gen X have prompted a new review of river water quality across North Carolina. We'll have details. North Carolina is about as far east as you can get in the United States, yet this state is now home to a new branch of online Western Governors University. University officials explain. Plus, you'll learn how government rules are blocking innovation in the funeral industry. Business owners are having a hard time reacting to customers' changing preferences. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
They're called Hometown Debates. It was a three-event series designed to engage the public in a conversation about three key areas related to education in North Carolina. The series was sponsored by the North Carolina Institute for Political Leadership. Now, our next guest was a Hometown Debate panelist, along with a number of state legislators and other policy analysts who held differing views. Dr. Terry Stoops is Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, you were at all three of these debates, so you really got a sense, I would think, of what the views are across the spectrum in this state, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And such lively discussion and timely topics for us to tackle in this off-election year. And so I think these kind of debates help to foster the kind of dialogue that we need about key issues in education.
Well, key issues, number one, that we have seen an interesting debate over the last several years about how we compensate teachers in North Carolina. We know that there have been a series of pay raises for teachers, but it was interesting that one of these debates focused on the issue of performance pay, merit pay. What was your view on that?
Well, I think we should go full steam ahead and have some sort of differentiated pay. Now, there was certainly a lot of question among the panelists about what would be the best way of going about doing that and whether there are some ways that are better than others. One person that watched this debate called it the most lively debate of the three. And this was lively because people, of course, are interested in teacher compensation. And there are a lot of worries that differentiating pay based on performance, based on skills, based on the subject that you teach might be controversial, might cause some teachers to leave the profession, and I think also would attract some to the profession if we did it right.
Terry, a lot of folks might be listening to us, and if they've worked in a government situation outside the teaching world or in private enterprise, they might be thinking, well, gee, that's what happens every day. You know, when you go to work, you're working with people, you're competing, everybody gets different raises, presumably based on your performance. Why would the education community believe that there's something that troubling about that for the system?
Well, they believe that the competition is unhealthy. And one of the things that I objected to is the idea that teachers don't compete. And teachers really do compete. And they can still work together even though they're getting paid a different amount of money. Now, if you look at the way we pay teachers now based on a state salary schedule that is based on the number of years of experience and the credentials that you have, that's really not an effective way to pay teachers because it doesn't recognize that some teachers do more work than others. Some teachers teach subjects that are harder to hire teachers for, and that there are some teachers that just outperform based on student test scores other teachers in that building.
I'm sure that was a lively debate because we know that this always really fosters a lot of discussion from across the spectrum, as do the issue of public charter schools and school choice in general. And we know that having you a guest on this show frequently talking about the growth of choice in North Carolina, it was interesting, I thought, that one of the debates focused on whether or not the state should really kind of clamp down on oversight of public charter schools and private schools as well. Why is that an issue?
Well, it's an issue because many believe that there are the oversights that are in place are loose on voucher recipient schools and charter schools. And the point that I tried to make throughout this debate, and I don't know that the opponents, those on the other side thought much of this argument, but that parents are the ultimate accountability mechanism. So in their mind, the way that we need to keep them accountable is for them to take a test and then those test scores to be reported. And for them, that is the only and the best way to keep these schools accountable. But what they forget and what they often don't realize or appreciate is the fact that parents are an accountability mechanism as well. The choice that they make to send state money to these schools, to private schools or charter schools, is a much more powerful way to keep these schools accountable, because if you're not keeping these parents happy, they'll just go to another school and the funding runs out. So that was the basis of the argument that I tried to make, that we need to look beyond just test-based accountability and look at the ways that parents can be used as an accountability mechanism, especially in a state where a lot of people complain that we have too many tests. It would seem to me very logical to have parents be the accountability mechanism and not a state test.
I think I have heard you and probably read some of your work on this, where you've put it sort of this way. This is my paraphrase, that parents talk with their feet and they walk away if they don't like the school option that they've chosen. And so that in and of itself is the accountability mechanism.
That's right. And we shouldn't assume necessarily that parents are going to choose a school for one reason or another. A student may do terribly on a test at a school of choice, and that may be due to the fact that they're several grades behind or they were bullied at their old school. The assumption is always that parents want to move their children based on academic concerns, but I think safety concerns, commuting concerns are just as much of a valid reason to pursue a school of choice than tests and student performance. And I think that that is certainly something that was lost on the opponents in this debate as well.
One of the points that you often make, Terry, that I think is really, really important, is that as school choice grows and more parents choose options other than a traditional public school classroom, and of course the majority of parents still choose that, that that is downward pressure on the need to build more schools in North Carolina. And in fact, one of the debate topics for the Hometown Debate series was the state's role in financing school construction. What's the key issue there?
Well, the key issue is who should pay. There was agreement from participants on both sides of the aisle that there are school construction needs that are not being met. The real issue is, what role should the state have in providing for school facilities? Traditionally, it is a local issue. The county commission is charged with overseeing school facilities for the school districts that are in their county. And they are the ones that are supposed to assume some debt for school facilities in order to build them and renovate them. In the past, the state has taken some role. There have been statewide bonds for school facilities. There have been tax revenue that's been filtered from the state to the localities for school construction. And of course, now we have the lottery. Part of the lottery revenue goes to school construction. So the question is, should the state do more? Should we have more lottery money going for school facilities? How should we deal with the fact that there are some counties that just don't have the tax base to be able to support large-scale debt for school construction, and what role does the state play in that?
What's your view?
Well, I think that there is a role for the lottery here. I think the lottery revenue is an original source of funding for school facilities. It's been that way since the start of the lottery in 2006. So we should be mindful of making sure that as much lottery funding as possible goes to these school districts. I think it's also important for school districts to look at ways they can partner with the private sector to be able to find public-private partnerships and cooperative enterprises to make school facilities better for students. That may mean renting out space. That may mean building new schools. It may mean renovating the schools that exist. I don't think we do enough to engage with our private sector and see how they can become partners in the school construction enterprise.
That's interesting, because typically when you hear folks talk about we have a growing population, more kids are coming into school, we need more seats, the conclusion is a kind of prejudge that we must build something. But you're saying maybe you rent it, maybe you lease it, look at some other options, maybe just be a little bit more open-minded to what we might do.
Absolutely. I mean, charter schools don't receive funds from the state, and this is what they do. They rent, they bring in private sector to help them find the facilities that they need.
Terry, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Are you wondering where our country is headed? Well, so are two of our most revered presidents. Spend an evening with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. That's right, Jefferson and Adams visit the Museum of History in Raleigh for a debate on the future of the United States. Hear what Jefferson and Adams think about national security, foreign engagement, and the role of government. While time has passed since they led our country, the issues and challenges endure. It's Living History, a Living History event starring two incredible actors, Monday evening, November 20th, brought to you by the organization dedicated to advancing freedom, the John Locke Foundation. Find details at johnlocke.org. That's John Locke with an E .org, or call 866-JLF-INFO. Monday evening, November 20th, at the Museum of History in Raleigh. Tickets, $10 per person, but just $5 for students. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, live in Raleigh, November 20th. Hope to see you there.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Carolina Journal Radio is a project of the John Locke Foundation. So who was this John Locke fellow? A 17th century British philosopher, a major influence on the American founders. And our next guest emphasizes another important aspect of John Locke. Duke University professor Michael Munger recently addressed the John Locke Foundation. His presentation focused on the following question. Was John Locke the first modern economist? Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. And the qualified answer is yes. Yes, he was the first modern economist. And 100 years before Adam Smith.
You take a look at this by examining a piece of John Locke's writing that's not one of the ones that even the Locke experts spend a lot of time on.
It's almost unknown. And it was suggested to me by a friend who said, you might want to look at this, because she knew I was interested in the question of price gouging and whether prices were just. And she was absolutely right. The piece is called Venditio, and it's available just as a handwritten little piece of foolscap. It was found in 1691, and it's still available. In fact, I distributed handwritten copies, literal photocopies of the handwritten version of it in my talk here at the Locke Foundation. It's only 4 pages long, and the question that Venditio poses is the market price just? That is, are you justified in charging the market price? Would a good person charge or buy at the market price, or should you do something else? And Locke's answer is fascinating, because he intuits what modern microeconomics took until the 1950s to more or less prove. If there's many buyers and many sellers, and the product is homogeneous, yes, the market price is always just. The question is, what happens when you don't have a well-developed market like that? And then he adds to this, is only in 4 pages, just in 4 pages, he adds to that an ethical theory that we're kind of still wrestling with. And, you know, he probably wrote it in some late afternoon when it's dark and rainy outside, because he lived in England.
And this was when he was not thinking about how you should run a government and other things. Well, on the side, let's invent a modern economics.
About the nature of epistemology, about the nature of contracts. He was really a remarkable guy.
When you first came across this publication after it was recommended to you, were you surprised that you had never heard that Locke had these insights before?
I considered myself to be something of a scholar of Locke. So not only was I surprised that I hadn't, I was convinced that this was something that the discipline needed, that political science and economics needed it. So 2 years ago, I published from Oxford University Press an anthology in PPE, and we added this. So now it's actually available in print. There aren't many places it's available in print, but the Oxford PPE anthology contains the Venditio.
We are speaking with Professor Michael Munger of Duke University on this question of whether John Locke was the first modern economist. When you read this four-page piece, does he capture things correctly, or like in other areas of Locke's writing, are there some things that he doesn't quite get right that need a little bit more fleshing out?
Well, it's only four pages, but to be fair, and maybe there's an error, there's a little bit of anachronism. That is, I'm using my knowledge of modern microeconomics to fill in the gaps between what he says. But much of what he says about price is right. The reason that we need price, and we're talking about this in the literal shadow of the flooding in Texas, and I've heard the Texas Attorney General saying that he's going to enforce anti-gouging laws. Well, the question is, what does price actually do for us? Very few people are educated enough about economics. I think this is catastrophic. Very few people know enough about economics to recognize how important price is. And Locke clearly understood that. He understood secondary markets. He understood the role of price in signaling where resources and assets should be sent. That's pretty amazing.
John Locke wrote in the 17th century. We're in the 21st century. Why is it that insights that he had that long ago are still up for debate now and people don't get them?
They were controversial then. I don't think he persuaded anyone. And what I find so fascinating about it is that the Venditio actually contains four examples that he uses to illustrate his points. So it's really useful pedagogically. It's not really a theoretical piece, but it's a good thing for teaching because you ask these questions that he asks and then use them for students' discussion. And I've often had people say, after hearing this, I've actually changed my mind about price gouging laws. I understand why some people might favor them, but price gouging laws are probably a bad idea. Almost no one believes that. We do a bad job at economic education in high school and in college.
If John Locke came up with these insights that long ago, when did we really see other more known economic scholars come to these same conclusions or at least tackle these same issues?
In some way, David Hume did in the 18th century. Certainly, Smith did in the 18th century, but I would say Alfred Marshall in the very end of the 19th century was really the first to recognize the importance of the role of price in allocating resources. And since then, we tend to have problems with this theory of price because we think, well, it's not fair. Well, a lot of things aren't fair. The question is, what's the best that we can do in difficult circumstances? And price should work for us, not against us.
You mentioned that this Venditio is very helpful pedagogically in the classroom. Is it the type of thing that you'd like to see more economics instructors employ? Does it help students actually have that aha moment?
I think it does, and I think it's something that's really appropriate for high school. And it's actually available a couple of places online now. So if you're interested in using it in a high school class or a college class, if you just Google Venditio, you can easily find it online. It's easily available. I, of course, think that it's useful as part of the book that I published. But I hope that people will – I've also tried to publish some explications, some ways of teaching it. So I'd be happy to try to share those. The nice thing about it is it doesn't really reach many conclusions itself. It poses these questions, and then students can explore what they think are the ethical and practical issues of trying to implement a system where we use price to allocate resources.
It sounds as if this is another way in which John Locke can really prove valuable to people today. I mean, we see him as valuable in sharing some of the ideas about freedom and limited government and serving the governed.
Well, and his letter on toleration.
Right.
It's really the breadth of his interests is amazing. When you add this economic work and his work on money, you could basically have a college curriculum just looking at Locke's work and its extensions.
When you do use this piece, you mentioned that there are some people who actually do change their minds about price gouging. Do you hope that that continues to be true, that other people will employ this same tool and tell people – what you think about price gouging isn't what is actually so?
Well, price gouging is a bad thing. Cutting people open with a sharp piece of metal is a bad thing. But if they have appendicitis, you may need to do it. So high prices after an emergency are a way of signaling other people what we most need. So I'm not advocating price gouging. What I'm saying is that allowing price to do its work can be of great help in an emergency because the state is not very good at bringing these things in.
The author of that piece was Venditio, the person who has helped bring it to light and expose it in a book and otherwise, is Duke Professor Michael Munger. Thanks so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you wondering where our country is headed? Well, so are two of our most revered presidents. Spend an evening with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. That's right, Jefferson and Adams visit the Museum of History in Raleigh for a debate on the future of the United States. Hear what Jefferson and Adams think about national security, foreign engagement, and the role of government. While time has passed since they led our country, the issues and challenges endure. It's Living History, a Living History event starring two incredible actors, Monday evening, November 20th, brought to you by the organization dedicated to advancing freedom, the John Locke Foundation. Find details at johnlocke.org. That's John Locke with an E.org, or call 866-JLF-INFO. Monday evening, November 20th, at the Museum of History in Raleigh. Tickets, $10 per person, but just $5 for students. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, live in Raleigh, November 20th. Hope to see you there.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. People in southeastern North Carolina worry about the potential impact of Gen X. It's a chemical dumped for years into the Cape Fear River. Meanwhile, state lawmakers from that area are looking into river water quality issues surrounding Gen X. Republican Holly Grange represents part of New Hanover County.
I'm happy to see so many people here that are willing to help provide us with information that we are seeking in order to not only solve the problem down in our area, but also to make sure that something like this does not happen again. This is the Select Committee on North Carolina River Quality. It's not the Select Committee on the Cape Fear Region River Quality. So we want to make sure that what we accomplish in this committee is going to be applied throughout the entire state.
Republican Frank Eiler represents neighboring Brunswick County.
We've been operating, I'm afraid, to some degree, in fear and maybe shared ignorance, which is, I hate to use a harsh term, but I feel like we need information more than anything else, and we need true information. I'm glad to see we're going to have scientific folks on the agenda, as well as others who have an interest in purifying our water, And I've started saying around everywhere I speak, and by the way, we have about 100,000 plus users of the Cape Fear River water in our county, in Brunswick County. Everywhere I've talked to people, I said I'd like to know what's in the water before it goes in instead of afterward. And but we also want to operate from a position of not fearing what is maybe not supposed to be feared, but be sure that we do fear what is what needs to be feared.
Republican Ted Davis of New Hanover County explained what his legislative committee is designed to do.
If we're going to meet and do what we are charged to do, then we need to get all the facts and all the information we can receive to investigate and obtain as much information as possible to determine, number one, how did we get here? That's very important. You've got to know before you can do anything to solve the problem to find out what caused the problem and what has happened through the years that has gotten us to where we are today. And then, how can we prevent this from happening in the future, which has been alluded to earlier? The bottom line for the speaker, as well as I see for this committee, is to protect the people of not only the Cape Fear River region, but also all the other areas in this state from pollution and contamination that has a negative impact on the quality of their drinking water. Because obviously that is an extremely important issue that we need to address.
That's State Representative Ted Davis. He's one of the leaders of a new committee studying river water quality in North Carolina. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors, the recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation, we're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina is about as far east as you can get in the United States, but that isn't stopping the online Western Governors University from setting up shop here. WGU unveiled its plans at a news conference at the state capitol. President Scott Pulsifer explained how Western Governors differs from other universities.
Our average age of our students is 37 years old. That's also true here in North Carolina. 70% of our students also have families, children. So you will often see that our graduates come and hear their children sitting in the audience and they're seeing their parents receive their degrees, whether they be a bachelor's or master's. These working adults are finding now the opportunity through the attainment of that credential to either advance the career that they were on or change a career or even achieve their first-time career. And you see that in kind of how we developed our programs. We designed our programs also to start from the very simple fact that if education is a path to opportunity, you need to make sure that the programs that you're offering are more linked to that opportunity than not. And so we designed our colleges around that. We have four colleges. Our first college was in health professions. Our second one was in teaching. Our first one was in business. Our second one is teaching. Then we added health professions, and then we added our College of IT. We only have 65 programs across Western Governors University. It doesn't mean that we're not going to have more. It just means that we're very prudent about making sure that when we introduce new degrees, that those degrees provide a very strong link and a path to opportunity in the workforce. You won't be surprised as well to learn that those programs that we offer have very high demand.
Pulsifer says WGU already has served North Carolinians.
Today in North Carolina, we already have more than 1,100 students in 89 counties across North Carolina. We've also awarded just over 2,000 degrees. We have 2,007 degrees that have already been awarded to North Carolinians. That has actually broken down in this way. Across health professions and nursing, we have 648 graduates, teachers, 603 graduates, College of Business, 508 graduates, and the College of Information Technology, we have 248 graduates.
Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest is happy to see a new option for North Carolinians.
It really is a historic day, and it's a proud moment, I think, for North Carolina to see another opportunity for excellent education to be inserted into our state, really in a new way, in an innovative way. WGU is not coming in as a competitor to our university system, our community college system. It's coming in as a partner in that system, a system of education that needs to meet the needs of all of our citizens across North Carolina. It's found an innovative and unique way to reach into our communities and do just that. And so we should all be very proud of that fact. We should be proud that we are willing as a state to be innovative. We're willing as a state to kind of break the mold of education the way we've seen it historically. You know, we have a great university system, and they meet very specific needs, and they do a fantastic job doing that. And WGU comes in and says, you know what, we see some other needs in the community that need to be met. And they have the tools and the resources and the ability to be able to meet those needs.
Lou Ebert is president of the North Carolina Chamber. He also joined in the celebration.
Every day when we go visit our members, what's on their mind is the insatiable search for talent. So we've now come to a state where, if you were here 7 years ago, we were the people without jobs. Now we're in the mode of jobs without people. And so to have the Western Governors University show up here and be part of us helping to solve the skills gap comes at a wonderful time. This is the ninth largest state in America. We're the third fastest growing. And if we were in a freestanding economy, this would be the 30th largest economy in the world. So we might ask the Western Governors folks what took you so long, but we're glad you're here. You recognize North Carolina as a state of opportunity, as do we.
Catherine Truitt was the top education advisor for former Republican Governor Pat McCrory. She's taking on the job as the first chancellor of Western Governors University, North Carolina.
After 23 years in education, I still believe in the power of education to transform lives and to sustain our democracy. In this country, attainment of good education can still enable social mobility and success, and is the key to achieving the American dream. I believe that everyone has a right to this opportunity, regardless of zip code. And this belief has permeated every decision I've ever made in my professional life. For the first 12 years of my career, I taught English to students all over the United States and in the UK as my family moved with the military. My student-centered approach was considered different at that time. So even then, I was labeled a disruptive innovator. But my efforts impacted lives one student at a time. In 2012, I began working with a group called the International Center for Leadership and Education, and we helped teachers and administrators turn troubled schools around by choosing a student-centric approach to running a school rather than the typical adult-centric approach. And we helped change schools one school at a time. As the former governor's senior education advisor, I had the opportunity to develop a deep understanding of our state's commitment to innovation in education.
Truitt explained how Western Governors University fits into North Carolina's recent history of education innovation.
North Carolina was a forerunner in the establishment of high-quality standards for early childhood education. And just a few months ago, our legislator created the Birth Through Third Grade Council that will examine those policies and practices that will make high-quality early childhood education possible for our youngest citizens. Our state's transition to digital age learning has laid the foundation for a more personalized, individual approach to K-12 education that is already producing incredible results in some of our most economically disadvantaged counties. We have an early college high school in North Carolina that is the envy of other states, allowing students across North Carolina to take community college classes while still in high school and graduate with an associate degree for free. Our North Carolina community college system is the third largest in the country, and no one in North Carolina lives more than 30 minutes from a community college or a satellite campus. So these innovations are part of our state's larger efforts to transform education in North Carolina, one system at a time. And now we have WGU North Carolina.
Truitt explained why she supports Western Governors University's model.
The WGU model will allow more North Carolinians to attain a degree, because although everyone in North Carolina may live within 30 minutes of a community college, many thousands do not live within 30 minutes of a four-year institution. Or how many live close to a school but cannot attend because of work or family demands? WG North Carolina's unique model will allow these students to earn a degree at an affordable cost, which will transform families one family at a time. North Carolina has more troops stationed here than in any other state. We will be able to help soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and their families obtain a degree without leaving their base. And this will be good for our military and our economy. I wish that when I was a Navy spouse that I had had the opportunity to go to WGU, but unfortunately we didn't have internet back then. So WGU's ability to be simultaneously student-centered and innovative will enhance our existing educational system in this state, helping more North Carolinians achieve their dreams.
That's Catherine Truitt, named recently as the first chancellor of Western Governors University, North Carolina. WGU and the state of North Carolina worked together to bring the online school to the state. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you wondering where our country is headed? Well, so are two of our most revered presidents. Spend an evening with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. That's right, Jefferson and Adams visit the Museum of History in Raleigh for a debate on the future of the United States. Hear what Jefferson and Adams think about national security, foreign engagement, and the role of government. While time has passed since they led our country, the issues and challenges endure. It's Living History, a Living History event starring two incredible actors, Monday evening, November 20th, brought to you by the organization dedicated to advancing freedom, the John Locke Foundation. Find details at johnlocke.org. That's John Locke with an E.org, or call 866-JLF-INFO. Monday evening, November 20th, at the Museum of History in Raleigh. Tickets, $10 per person, but just $5 for students. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, live in Raleigh, November 20th. Hope to see you there. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. It is one of the most difficult things we ever do, planning a funeral for someone we love. Yet gathering to remember the deceased is a cultural norm in the United States, which means we need a funeral industry that is growing to meet our demand. Now, some experts fear that we could be facing a crisis in this regard. They say that state and federal regulations are dissuading entrepreneurs from entering the funeral business. It is the cover story of the November issue of Carolina Journal, and Editor-in-Chief Rick Henderson is here with a preview. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
In North Carolina, what's actually required if you want to operate as a funeral director or open a funeral home?
A lot of training is something like 2 years of formal training plus a 1 year effective apprenticeship as a funeral director. There are fees involved that are required to be paid, plus continuing education requirements. And that's all for a job that average salary is around $50,000 a year. So it's a long amount of training, certification, and apprenticeship, background checks, all those sorts of things required for a job that really doesn't pay a whole lot when you consider what's required to get into it.
And that's not the only thing when we start talking about state requirements. And,
right.
And certainly, you know, public health and public safety issues,
yes,
are at play there. But that gets us into building codes.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you become licensed, you've entered into the industry, then can you just go rent a building and open up?
No, you have to have it. There are very stringent building codes required from funeral homes and mortuaries, all the way to the level of having a separate sewer system, if you will, for disposing of the waste there, even though your own municipal sewer system probably is as strict as it needs to be to handle what would be removed as waste from a funeral home. And there are growing regulations of things like how you would dispose of the refuse there anyway. I mean, you can't just take it out and burn it. You can't just dump it in the back. I mean, there are all sorts of other regulations required the safe disposal of the materials that are used there. But the funeral homes, funeral parlors have to go over and above that. And some people say that's excessive because it's a very capital intensive industry.
So if you wanted to actually do this, I mean, you've got to be able to come up with either money on your own or find an investor.
Right.
So licensing and becoming qualified to actually do this kind of obviously very specialized, important work in our country. But then you've got all these rules you have to meet.
Yeah, and that's why the industry is largely a family industry. You quite often will see funeral homes and mortuaries that have been in the same family for generations, and that's because it's very capital intensive. Also, it's very much of a relationship-based industry, as you would imagine. And so in a lot of smaller towns to medium-sized cities, the funeral home, the funeral director, is someone who's been in the community for a long, long time and has built the trust of people. But it's not the sort of business that then tends to attract a lot of outsiders if you're dealing with such an intimate and personal sort of business.
Rick, in the cover story for the November issue of Carolina Journal, associate editor Lindsay Marcello writes the story, and she talked with an expert, I believe in Wake Forest,
right,
who is very concerned that the piling up of all of these regulations, all the state requirements we've talked about, plus a federal requirement on pricing, I believe, that
yes,
we haven't mentioned yet, is really reaching the point where it's just too much for people to get into the industry.
Yeah, that's right. Lindsay talked to Tanya Marsh, who's a professor at Wake Forest University, who is the nation's expert on the funeral industry and the mortuary business. And she notes that right now, even though the industry itself accounts for about $21 billion a year across the country, that the average funeral, if you're dealing with an interment, is about $8,000 to $10,000.
Wow.
Which is a lot of money. If you instead go the cremation route, you're talking about maybe $1,000 to $2,500. And more and more people, rather than having the traditional funeral in which you would have a wake or receiving at the funeral home and then a service the next day and then a formal burial, are having memorial services at homes, at civic clubs, and churches, and are foregoing that route and just simply having the remains cremated.
And that's less expensive.
Much less expensive to do so. Because otherwise it can become a burden on a family, especially if low-income families.
That changing norm, more cremations, has a business impact. And that's another one of those reasons that the professor who's the expert in the industry is saying that there's some really big business questions for the funeral industry that really need to be addressed in terms of trying to attract people into it.
Right. Well, I mean, there are state laws, for instance, that we cite some in the story. For instance, in Texas, you cannot take embalmed remains across state lines. There are rules and regulations that have to deal with what you can do with cremated remains, for instance. There are issues with what sort of sanitation levels do you have to maintain in an embalming area. There are issues of what you can do. How green does your casket have to be, for instance?
Oh my!
there's a growing industry now of saying that you can't use, you know, the marble and chrome and steel caskets anymore. Now you have to have something that's degradable over time. It's gotten to the point now in which every imaginable interest group that could handle getting its fingers into this industry has done so. And so because of that, a lot of the insiders in the industry don't want competition. And so they are wanting to keep those barriers in place so that they can keep competitors out. And so you've actually had lawsuits filed by groups like the Institute for Justice that have challenged state laws that required you to purchase your casket from the funeral home, not purchase it from an outside vendor. And that way,
a lot of people don't even know that that's possible to do.
That's right.
Purchase a casket from a store.
Although you can buy a casket at Costco, for instance, in a lot of states. But what you would do is then that would be a way for the funeral director to recoup some of the higher regulatory costs that are out there that it has to cover that it might not be able to do through a competitive marketplace of offering services. It captures that by charging more, a higher percentage for the casket. risk than it might otherwise.
Rick, all of these issues have not gone unnoticed by some members of North Carolina's General Assembly. And they, at one point during the last legislative session, actually talked about trying to make some reforms, some changes to laws about this. What's going on?
Well, there's a move to take a new look at the regulatory structure involving funeral services entirely. Professor Marsh says we're going to start from scratch. Just get rid of all of them with some sunset period and say what makes sense and what doesn't. For instance, right now, most mortuary services schools spend about half their time teaching people how to embalm corpses. Well, most corpses are not embalmed now. That rarely happens. In fact, you don't have to be embalmed. Corpses don't have to be embalmed to be buried. So if there are regulatory requirements that are increasing the cost of people getting into the business, and something like 40% of the number of licensed funeral directors in North Carolina have been lost since 2014. If that's what's going on, then surely there have to be some changes in the regulatory structure to keep this business more vibrant than it would be otherwise.
Well, it's a really fascinating cover story, the November issue of Carolina Journal. Well, Rick, it's kind of an uncomfortable subject for a lot of people to talk about, but so glad that Lindsay Marcello of Carolina Journal really took a serious look at this issue of the funeral industry in North Carolina. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.